Oasis Audio presents The Thing You Think You Cannot Do by Gordon Livingston, M.D. Read for you by Sean Renette. Introduction. Fear is the central issue of our time. Once an adaptive emotion that protected our ancestors on the plains of Africa, fear has become a corrosive influence in modern life, eroding our ability to think clearly. Exploited for power by our political leadership and for money by the media, fear is embedded in the way we think about our lives. Our preoccupation with safety is a natural reaction to our vulnerability to loss. At the same time, the search for perfect safety is absurd, given the inevitability of our eventual demise. Even as our lives have become safer overall, our fears remain intact and lie at the foundation of our most revered institutions, notably religion, which typically promises some version of immortality as a salve for our dread of extinction. Americans live in an increasingly authoritarian society, out of persistent fear that other tribes in distant places are a threat to our way of life, to our very existence. Over the last century, this apprehension has brought us to a continual state of war, which shows no sign of abating. And although we congratulate ourselves for being a peace-loving people, our national anthem is a tribute to fighting off threatening foreigners. Because I am, by accident of birth, an American, the reader will find that most societal references in this book derive from this place and time. However, I have tried to choose themes with universal meaning and application. As a psychiatrist, I spend my professional life in the presence of fearful people. An entire category of mental disorders is characterized by anxiety, a distress of the mind typified by worry and dread. This disorder is usually distinguished from fear by the fact that anxiety may have no specific object, except when it takes the form of so-called phobias, of crowds, of flying, or of driving, for example. When anxiety is acute, its physiological symptoms are identical to those of fear: sweating, rapid heartbeat, muscular tension. We are, in short, manifesting the once adaptive fight-or-flight phenomenon, except that neither of these responses may now be called for. More common triggers in the present day are things such as public speaking, taking a test, or rejection in love. Fears of failure and humiliation have replaced the threat of imminent death as our most common sources of apprehension. Collectively, our fears take the form of a pervasive worry that supports huge therapeutic and pharmaceutical industries devoted to the alleviation of emotional distress. Because I work in one of these industries, I routinely employ medications, but I have found myself in recent years invoking virtues such as courage and resilience as alternatives to the sense of victimization and helplessness that medical diagnoses often engender. On the wall of my office hangs a 1915 picture of the British explorer Ernest Shackleton's ship Endurance, trapped in the ice of the Weddell Sea near Antarctica. His ultimately successful battle for his crew's survival has much to teach us about the courage required to confront adversity of all sorts. What are we afraid of? And what can we do about it? A partial list of fears that I deal with in those seeking psychotherapy include fear of dying, fear of change, fear of intimacy, fear of loss, fear of failure, fear of success, fear of inadequacy, fear of time, fear of loneliness, fear of the unknown. With a little thought, you can doubtless make your own list. Interestingly, anxiety, like its frequent companion, depression, appears to have an element of heritability. You are more likely to suffer excessive apprehension if other members of your biological family are similarly afflicted. No one is sure how this predisposition passes from one generation to the next or on what chromosome or chromosomes it is manifest. Although we will probably find the answer over the next few years, will we then have learned anything about alleviating anxiety itself? This biological inclination is the reason that most treatment for anxiety includes the use of one medication or another. Drugs that increase serotonin levels in the brain, The SSRI antidepressants are effective against chronic anxiety. Minor tranquilizers such as Xanax, Ativan, and Klonopin provide significant short-term relief, but have the disadvantage of chemical dependency. Psychotherapy also frequently helps, and it is about this process and what it teaches that I will have more to say. The best psychological antidote to anxiety turns out to be some combination of hope and courage. How these virtues are acquired, manifested, and taught are at the core of this book. It is not easy to live a courageous life, and no one is brave all the time or in every circumstance. Accepting our own mortality becomes most problematic in our middle years. We seek to slow the aging process and to embody the misleading adage that you are only as old as you feel. Some people panic and imagine that they can recapture their youth with new activities, possessions, or relationships. In the movie Moonstruck, someone asks at the dinner table, "Why do men cheat?" The Olympia Dukakis character replies simply, "Fear of death." In middle age, we confront our limitations and the slow demise of our dreams. Our best hopes for ourselves have been tested against reality and customarily found wanting. The love of our youth no longer resembles the image in the wedding pictures. Nor do we. If we are lucky, we are bored. If unlucky, we impulsively rearrange and often ruin our lives. If we are like many people, we have already divested ourselves of our first spouse and are dissatisfied with our second or third. Too cynical, you say? Look at the divorce statistics and count the couples you know who are truly happy. Our children need us less, and our jobs do not usually promise excitement, yet we are glad to have them. We may even be less successful than our parents. We wonder what happened to the universal hope for generational upward mobility. A surprising number of Americans are depressed. In the adult population, 9.5%, or 22 million people, will suffer from clinical depression in any given year. The dividing line between existential sadness or discouragement and the kind of depression for which medication is recommended is blurred. As evidence, 54 million of us are on antidepressants at any given moment. Some of this number may be the result of overprescribing, but most epidemiologists believe that clinical depression is diagnosed and treated less often than it occurs. In the face of this malaise, an argument can be made that we live in a culture of fear. For example, we are consumers of advertising that is focused on the proposition that material possessions, including pharmaceutical products, can compensate for feelings of inadequacy, creating the illusion that we can buy, or at least rent, happiness. Many American cultural icons are wealthy people who display a relentless selfishness. And the growing disparity between the rich and the middle class, not to mention the 12.6% of the country living in poverty, is a testimony to our failure to look after one another in any responsible way. Here's another statistic to ponder. The poorest 20% of Americans earn 3.4% of the national income. The richest 20% earn 49.4%. That ratio, 14.5 to 1, is the highest it has ever been. The street protests of the aggrieved 99% testify to a growing public consciousness of the unfairness in income distribution and political influence, not just in the United States, but also worldwide. Our proudest value, the rationale for all our wars, is freedom. But what about other values, such as courage, hope, charity, and justice? An unsparing look at what we have become, a devout, militarized, defensive, xenophobic, and selfish society, reveals a bleak picture. We need to see ourselves as we are if we are going to change this version of ourselves. Otherwise, we will continue to be manipulated by our fears, that is, by the angels of our baser nature. I have spent some time at war and watched young men struggle with issues of prolonged fear, attachment, and meaning more vividly than is normally the case in our daily lives. Discovering who reacted with steadfastness and concern for others under the threat of imminent death was often surprising. Nearly everyone is afraid in combat. Those few who are not are in a special category and are dangerous to themselves and those around them. In Moby Dick, Starbuck says, "I will have no man in my boat who is not afraid of a whale." Overcoming fear of death to act on behalf of the unit is the military definition of valor. Courage can take many other forms, few of which result in medals. Moral courage, for example, was called by Robert Kennedy a more rare commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Someone who sacrifices his reputation or career on behalf of an ideal is seldom celebrated. A government employee who resigns rather than carry out an unlawful order. A whistleblower who exposes corporate malfeasance. A soldier who makes public the secrets of an illegitimate war. All take risks on behalf of their fellow citizens and the truth. This book is about personal traits and values and how they are taught and exhibited. Any discussion of fear and courage has political overtones because the philosophies we admire and adopt individually find inevitable expression in our choice of leaders. In a democracy, our ideals are both shaped and reflected by those we elect to office. These larger issues are inseparable from the ways in which we experience our lives at a personal level. One does not have to be a political scientist to see this connection. Throughout the book, I explore the crucial questions of how we deal with fear at both an individual and a societal level. We routinely face situations that make us anxious, that test our convictions about ourselves and what we wish our lives to be. In our everyday decisions, we either accept the limitations that fear would impose upon us or refuse to be cowed, and so act in ways congruent with our deepest values and fondest hopes. We are not what we say, or how we feel, or what we think. We are what we do. Fear is both a noun and a verb, an emotion and a way of engaging or not engaging those around us. Courage is manifest by action. It is habitual and the only non-pharmacologic antidote to the apprehension that is inevitable in an uncertain and often dangerous world. And finally, I've learned this. A working sense of humor may be our last, best defense against fear. Remember those who declared after 9/11 that everything has changed and we would not laugh again? How wrong they were. You gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You must do the thing which you think you cannot do. Eleanor Roosevelt. Chapter 1. It is dying that makes life important. I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. Woody Allen. Death is the fundamental fear from which most others derive. Every sentient creature struggles against the threat of extinction. What makes humans unique, so far as we know, is the ability to contemplate our demise. From this comes our longing for immortality and our fondness for a religion that promises everlasting life. We struggle against the relentless passage of time with its attendant losses, all of which are rehearsals for the final loss of ourselves. However unsuccessfully we have dealt with fear in our lives, usually by avoidance or distraction, most of us have a final chance to be brave in the way we face our deaths. Used to explain everything from cowardice in battle to our persistent search for perfect love, the consciousness of death is never far from the surface. Although most of us hold it at bay when we are young through the use of what might be called healthy denial, the shadow of our mortality is what lends intensity to the present moment. We construct elaborate belief systems to soften the finality of death and ascribe to each person a soul that outlives us. This longing for immortality is simultaneously the most comforting and the most divisive way that we assert our humanity. Worshipping a God who gives us rules to follow to attain everlasting life is not enough. Instead, we declare that the gods worshipped by those unlike ourselves are illegitimate, and out of this intolerance has come appalling violence. Few believers can see themselves as accidental victims of childhood indoctrination, born to particular parents in a particular place and time, raised to believe in their parents' God to the exclusion of all others, part of a tribal group of fellow believers who feel threatened by the knowledge that their beliefs are not universal, that in other places people pray to different gods with the same hope and fervor and exclusivity that we feel. These others are not just wrong and condemned to eternal perdition, but also frequently seen as dangerous and eager to impose their beliefs on us, through violence if necessary. More than territory or resources or power, differences in religion account for a staggering share of the destruction that human beings have visited on one another. Some claim that the great wars of the 20th century were not religious. But political systems, language, and ethnicity all represent equivalent beliefs, secular religions, that distinguish one group of people from another and undermine our sense of common humanity. We can classify groups as the other and less deserving of life in many ways. Religion is still prominent among them in our 21st century world. Little public attention is focused on the question of the importance of meaning in our lives. When asked to describe what their lives mean beyond a desire to get ahead, most Americans fall back on some religious formulation. We are a churchy country, more so than almost any developed society. When polled, 96% of us say that we believe in God and so believe in some form of life after death in which the good are rewarded and the wicked punished. This belief in a better afterlife allows us to tolerate a lot of earthly unhappiness and inequity and mitigates against behavior toward other people that would instill a sense of meaning in our lives right now. Whatever heaven we believe awaits us, few seem in a hurry to get there. A large element of subconscious doubt about immortality is expressed by the way we cling to whatever life we know, no matter how burdensome or unhappy it may be. In this, we are like other animals that presumably have no concept of a soul or a life everlasting. No matter our belief systems, we share with them a primitive fear of non-existence. The difference is that we must live our entire lives with the anticipation of death. What is required of us to accept our mortality and retain hope in a future in which we will not participate? People suffering from anxiety, fear without a specific object, routinely become subject to panic attacks characterized by frightening physical sensations, rapid heartbeat, hyperventilation, sweating, and a sense that they are about to die. Hospital emergency departments regularly encounter patients with these symptoms. Sometimes these episodes have a trigger, an auto accident, for example. Often no precipitant is discernible. People wake up from a sound sleep, gasping for air. Although it may seem reassuring to tell such people that tests confirm that nothing is wrong with their hearts, customarily they remain terrified of a recurrence of these feelings. No one lives an anxiety-free life. Like other forms of pain, anxiety is a warning that something is amiss, so anxiety is useful if it helps identify the imbalance and stimulates an effort to correct it. Such corrections usually require some combination of medication and psychotherapy. Left untreated, recurrent anxiety can shrink a life, sometimes to the confines of one's own house. Short of this outcome, a person's freedom to operate in the world can become so severely limited that he or she avoids situations that are likely to provoke even mild anxiety. Crowds, driving, crossing bridges, and the like. Such avoidance behaviors increase fears and promote withdrawal. Truly life-threatening situations can produce reactions identical to a panic attack. However, the military has discovered that through training and unit cohesion, one can overcome fear and learn to function even when bullets are cracking nearby. One can, in other words, train people to be brave by convincing them that their survival depends on their courage. At its best, Psychotherapy is another form of training people to confront their deepest fears while clarifying the unhappy consequences of avoidance. Tolerance for risk is an individual characteristic. Some people seek out danger and enjoy the adrenaline rush provided by leaping from airplanes, climbing walls of rock, or otherwise embracing activities that terrify most of us. As a whole, our society is risk-averse. Safety first has become a mantra, plastered on trucks and on workplace walls. We are grateful to the police for taking risks on our behalf, but even they are part of a culture that favors caution and safety over courage and daring. SWAT teams took 4 hours to enter and clear Columbine High School after the shooters were dead, and at least one wounded person inside bled to death while waiting for help. The police in Norway exercised similar caution in approaching an island where a man with an assault rifle was methodically shooting young people. When Cheshire, Connecticut police in 2007 arrived at a home where they knew a family was being held by two men, they elected to wait for backup, even as a mother and two daughters were being murdered and the house set on fire. Routine police procedures have as a major goal the safety of the police, sometimes at the expense of the citizens they are there to protect. We are preoccupied with safety in our daily lives and imagine that some set of cautious behaviors will protect us from harm. Presumed threats to our security become magnified: crime, drugs, terrorism, while the real dangers to our survival, accidents, lifestyle choices, heart disease, and cancer, do not inhabit our nightmares until we or someone we love is affected by them. Our failure to address the issue of climate change represents the most vivid example of dangerous denial. Life is intrinsically unsafe. We can buckle our seatbelts and wear our bicycle helmets. We can stop smoking and take to the road in our running shoes. We can walk our children to the school bus and secure them in their car seats. But death will get us anyway, sooner or later. One commentator suggested that with all the emphasis on diet and exercise, in the future people will be lying around hospitals dying of nothing. None of us can avoid this knowledge. It informs our lives even as we try not to think about it and struggle to deny it by changing our appearances and worshiping at the altar of youth. Our fear of death also causes us to react with shock and anger when people die suddenly or in large numbers. When a plane crash occurs, we investigate and search for ways to make sure it will never happen again. When inevitably it does, the National Transportation Safety Board conducts another painstaking investigation. The result is an air travel system that has a steadily improving safety record, which is certainly reassuring if you are about to walk into a metal tube that will transport you to 5 miles above the earth and hurtle you toward your destination at 600 miles per hour. Yet the fantasy of perfect safety continues to elude us, and every now and then one of those metal tubes falls out of the sky. Much riskier is an activity we consider more prosaic: driving our cars. Each year, about 40,000 Americans are killed while driving, but we fear it less than flying because we remain earthbound. Less investigation is required because automobile accidents and the death they cause are considered by most of us as routine events, as long as they are happening to others. Although we consider building safer cars important and our seatbelt use is now at 85%, we also tune out most safe driving campaigns, and the ubiquitous baby on board signs remain a public celebration of fertility. A big problem when dealing with our fears is our poor record when evaluating which ones are grounded in reality and which are misplaced or exaggerated. We are notoriously poor at risk assessment. We buy guns for protection, for example, while statistics demonstrate that a gun in the house is much more likely to kill someone who lives there than the intruder of our nightmares. We have been through seasons in which certain well-publicized threats — shark attacks, killer bees, satanic cults in nursery schools — have come and gone. Other persistent apprehensions are more enduring, but of little validity. Road rage, internet stalking, vaccines, school shootings, being killed by terrorists. Not only does this cause us unnecessary anxiety, it renders us subject to manipulation by those who benefit, monetarily or politically, from our fears. Frightened people do not make good decisions. In the first decade of the 21st century, America became embroiled in two lengthy wars that were essentially fearful responses to the attacks of 9/11. Our media magnify threats, crime, for example, to keep us watching the news. Most people have a highly exaggerated fear of being the victim of violence because the airways are saturated with such reports. In the parlance of TV news, if it bleeds, it leads. In fact, violent crime has been decreasing in most places over the last 10 years. Truth, it turns out, is frequently a matter of emphasis. We lose track of the true meaning of courage, a virtue that requires both choice and risk. A pilot who makes a skillful landing on the Hudson River becomes a hero even though he had no choice if he was to save himself. A surgeon who saves a life is hailed as heroic even though he took no risk. Both the pilot and the surgeon protest that I was just doing my job, and we consider them modest rather than truthful. In idealizing everyone who wears a uniform, we demonstrate how much we need heroes, even if we have to construct them out of whole cloth. False stories about the heroism of Private Jessica Lynch and Corporal Pat Tillman, even the initial reports of the desperate firefight in the Bin Laden compound, are examples of the routine exaggerations of courage that are common in war. Stories of real heroism, such as the actions on 9/11 of the passengers on Flight 93, who organized themselves to die fighting rather than passively ride to their deaths, the man who jumps onto a subway track to save a stranger, the bystander who throws himself into the freezing Potomac River to rescue survivors of a plane crash, are rightly recognized as exceptional. Obviously, courage can take many forms. The sudden burst of physical risk that characterizes most bravery on the battlefield is different from the long-term dedication to principle that we think of as moral courage. Exhibiting one form of courage does not imply that one will be brave in other ways as well. We are all familiar with the stories of war heroes whose later lives collapsed in dishonesty, or the cases of highly decorated soldiers who return from combat and murder their wives. Perhaps the highest form of valor is the dedication to principle that requires both contemplation and determination over time. Sacrifices on behalf of others are often seen in those who choose religious vocations. The capacity for commitment that is implied in such choices may be motivated by some expectation of divine reward, but turning one's back on the pleasures of the world to improve the lives of others is the very definition of altruism. So perhaps the concept of benefit to others ought to be added to the elements of risk and choice in defining courageous behavior. This definition would eliminate all those who climb mountains alone or parachute off tall buildings. Acts that require a kind of bravery or foolhardiness, but are ultimately self-centered and are of no use, excepting entertainment, to anyone else. It is within ourselves, where we confront our deepest fears and insecurities, that we find our own forms of courage or cowardice. Like any virtue, bravery is manifest in our habitual actions. Fidelity to an ideal, risking ourselves to stand up for the powerless, refusing to crumble beneath the weight of time, all require a steadfastness that is uncommon in a culture dominated by glamour, celebrity, and instant gratification. Esse quam videri, to be and not to seem, is a dated but admirable motto, seldom manifested by the movie stars and sports personalities who inhabit our fantasies of success. Doctors, in whom people are taught to place their trust, are routinely disciplined for taking financial or sexual advantage of their patients and for providing substandard care. Air traffic controllers, even pilots, have been discovered sleeping on the job. Soldiers have been convicted of war crimes, but a uniform at the airport elicits statements of appreciation and sometimes a first-class upgrade. Support for the troops can become support for the war that is killing them. Bravery, like fear, is contagious. A big part of military training involves building unit cohesion, a mutual affection for and dependency on the people with whom you serve. Soldiers on the battlefield do not exhibit a lot of patriotic fervor, about which many of them are openly cynical. Instead, they speak to the obligation they feel to the people around them. This loyalty is most frequently the basis for acts of heroism. Certain populations appear to have an indomitable spirit, notably the English during the World War II bombing raids by Germany, and the Israelis in the face of terrorism. Contrast the steadfastness displayed by these populations and the American response to 9/11, which most resembled a national anxiety attack, in which we imagined that our entire way of life was being threatened by a relatively small and stateless group of radical Islamists. By declaring that we were in a war for survival, we became more like them. Angry, intolerant, ethnocentric, and willing to employ violence to promote our ideology. Vengeance drove us, though we labeled it justice, and we effectively altered parts of our Constitution relating to extralegal detentions, torture, and abrogation of our own civil rights as we tried to recapture our sense of safety and invulnerability. And what price did we pay for all of the above? Over 6,000 American dead, twice as many as perished in 9/11. At least 200,000 diagnosed with traumatic brain injury alone, more than 100,000 Afghanis and Iraqis dead, and $3 trillion that might have been spent on health care, education, or retiring the national debt. All that money, of course, has been borrowed. I think of these irreplaceable lives and colossal sums as the wages of fear. What have we gained? Are we safer now from terrorist attack than we were 10 years ago? Do the radical Islamists really threaten our way of life? What have we learned about ourselves? Our efforts to conquer our fears, or even to discern which ones are realistic, are impeded by what we see on our television screens and what we hear from our politicians. Everyone wants to be on the safe side, especially when we imagine that the threat is to our very existence. We cannot cope with our fear of death except by seeing it as a realistic apprehension that can, if we let it, provide a sense of urgency and a determination to extract pleasure and meaning from the present moment. Such moments, strung together, constitute our lives. Chapter 2. Fear is the death of reason. I've developed a new philosophy. I only dread one day at a time. Charlie Brown. A way of life that encourages living in the moment has a lot to recommend it. The past is unchangeable, the future unpredictable. What little we control in our lives can be exercised only right now. We like to think we behave rationally and that our actions are governed by a sober evaluation of consequences. But this idea ignores ample evidence that most of what we do is either habitual or the product of underlying motivations, emotions, impulses, and biases that constitute Freud's unconscious mind. No better example exists than our buying behavior, in which we are routinely manipulated by sophisticated forms of marketing that appeal to our unfulfilled longings to be someone other than who we are. Richer, younger, thinner, and with more hair, fewer wrinkles, and more friends. What is the downside of a billion-dollar industry devoted to creating this chronic dissatisfaction with ourselves? This relentless consumerism focuses on the most superficial aspects of what it means to be human, how we look, and what we own. A preoccupation with these attributes is the definition of self-absorption. The results of adopting such values can be seen in the most fundamental institution of society, marriage. On what do we base our decisions about whom to marry? Whenever a survey is done on the subject, the results show an interesting gender difference. Men are drawn to women who fit a rather narrow definition of physical attractiveness. Women look for a good provider. Half of marriages end in divorce. But what of those that endure? How many of them have provided lasting satisfaction to both partners? Research in this area is difficult because long married couples are reluctant to disclose that they have made a mistake that has lasted most of their lives. If we want to be generous, we could hope that at least half of those in unions that have persisted are reasonably satisfied with their choice. Many reasons other than emotional fulfillment, children and finances to name two, impel people to remain together. We are still confronted with the uncomfortable truth that marriage, the building block and economic engine of society, has a failure rate, as defined by mutual satisfaction, of at least 75%. Still, as the popularity of internet dating sites attests, practically all of us want to be married. If it is true that ideas are easier to love than people, perhaps it is the image of perfect love that draws us onward to our next relationship. For many of us who had good mothers, the memory of unconditional acceptance lives on in our subconscious, is our deepest longing. Because this effortless experience of being valued just as we are is hard to replicate in our adult lives, we are taught that we must settle for something less. How much less is at the heart of most marital difficulties. The fact that we keep trying, however, attests to another of our deepest fears: loneliness. In the hell that is prison, what further punishment can be used to motivate people who have already lost nearly everything that renders life worthwhile? The answer is solitary confinement. No better example exists of the importance of human connections, even in the most extreme circumstances. What allows one to get from day to day in a loud, dangerous, soul-numbing environment where one's freedom and choice of companions is so restricted? A place devoid of most of what we think of as attachment or caring. Even here, something is worse. Solitude. Little wonder, then, that our daily lives contain so many behaviors directed at establishing and maintaining a sense of connectedness with at least one other person. Other fears, death, humiliation, rejection, have in common the fact that we will do practically anything to avoid being alone. There is no emptier sound than the door closing behind us in a place we inhabit by ourselves. I work with many patients who have as a part of their unhappiness the conviction that when they were young, shallow, and uninformed, they made a choice of life partner that they have come to regret. Sometimes this unhappy outcome represents a mistake in judgment for which they must now pay a price. Often that price takes the form of an agonizing choice between breaking up a family or continuing an unsatisfying marriage. But often what is happening reveals a fear of intimacy. Here is how that story frequently goes. We are inclined in our closest relationships to replay our childhood conflicts. If one or both of our parents was unduly intrusive and controlling, we learn to have little confidence in our own judgments. We also tend to experience love as something that must be earned and traded like a commodity. This is the concept of contingent reinforcement. If we do certain things, get good grades, excel athletically, abide by parental rules, we feel secure and loved. If we misbehave or let our parents down, we anticipate a withdrawal of that love. This withholding is more painful than any punishment or limit setting that we may experience. The outcome of such a philosophy, particularly if it leads to adolescent power struggles, is a sense of love as a form of manipulation, a reward for good behavior. If we take this learning into our adult relationships, and why shouldn't we? We adopt a contractual sense of what it is to love and be loved. If you do this for me, I'll do that for you. This philosophy is inimical to the idea of true intimacy, in which the line between giving and receiving is blurred. And here is the fear. If I become too dependent upon another person, they may take advantage of me. I retain my ability to get what I want only by a process of negotiation and compromise. Mistrust, in other words, is built into the relationship. This unfortunate assumption that we get what we want only by demanding it is one reason why people find themselves in the same unsatisfying relationships over and over again. Only people who have a similar self-protective view of love will engage us in this game. They, too, are afraid of real closeness, equating it with vulnerability and loss of control. And so the distance between people who have this fear grows larger as life becomes more complex and the demands of children and jobs require more and more negotiation. Our interactions become controlling, critical, and unkind. The distance between instinctive mistrust and alienation decreases with time until, like any form of paranoia, we become what we most fear and are truly alone. Chapter 3. Matters of the heart or of state that begin with a lie rarely end well. In the depth of winter, I finally learned there was within me an invincible summer. Albert Camus. On September 11th, 2001, I was at work when my wife called and told me to get to a television. It didn't take much watching to comprehend the likely magnitude of this tragedy. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, would die. It was hard to know how to react, but I had a patient waiting to be seen and so went on with my day. As it happened, I had a class scheduled early that afternoon at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, the Military Medical School. In 1969, I had what might charitably be described as a falling out with the Army when I was a doctor in Vietnam. So each year for the last 20 years, I have spoken to medical students at USUHS about ethical conflicts inherent in military medicine. Around noon, I got in my car and headed for the Naval Medical Center in suburban Washington, D.C. The first thing I noticed was that the traffic coming out of Washington was unexpectedly heavy for that time of day. Just to be sure that the class had not been canceled, I called the medical school. No answer. Then I heard on the radio that the Pentagon had been attacked and concluded that all government business was finished for the day. What I didn't realize yet was that official Washington was in the process of executing a maneuver that can only be described as run for your life. I turned around and drove home. In subsequent days and weeks, as the country tried to come to terms with the loss of 3,000 of its citizens, we were further traumatized by the anthrax attacks that killed 5 people and made thousands of others wary about picking up their mail. The Washington area was subjected to the D.C. snipers, who killed 13 before they were apprehended. In the further aftermath of 9/11, the stock market collapsed and several airlines went out of business for lack of passengers. We were, in short, well and truly terrorized. What was striking about our reaction to this attack was the gap between our patriotic protestations, home of the brave, and our behavior, which was driven by fear and a thirst for vengeance. We were eager to strike back at our attackers and rallied around our political leadership who promised to do so. Every single politician had to respond affirmatively to the question, "Are we at war?" And it was but a moment before the B-52s were bombing and the tanks were rolling, albeit down the roads of a country that had nothing to do with the attacks. Anyone who suggested that the stateless terrorists who had brought down those buildings constituted a criminal conspiracy that might better be dealt with through law enforcement or unconventional military forces, was shouted down as insufficiently patriotic. This was Pearl Harbor, and these terrorists were the 21st century equivalent of the Empire of Japan. Our freedoms were under attack, and our national existence was at stake. What, finally, do we have to show for the war on terror? Were we lied to? Have we relinquished anything of value in terms of our place in the world and our own self-respect as a constitutional democracy, a nation of laws, a champion of human rights? One of the interesting sidelights of our response to the September 11th attacks was the reflex characterization of the terrorists as cowards. One can call them many things: murderers of the innocent, suicidal lunatics, religious fanatics, the embodiment of evil. But viewed objectively, it is hard to sustain an allegation of cowardice against men who were willing to sacrifice their lives for what they believed, however misguided and homicidal they may have been. Part of our rage could be attributed to the fact that they could not be brought to justice because they had inflicted the death penalty on themselves. So we grabbed as many people as we could who looked like them and appeared to believe the same things, tortured many of them, and threw them in foreign prisons without due process. What does it mean to each of us to be a citizen of a country that, for a time at least, had as its national policy the torture of other human beings? Such are the wages of fear. Contrast this with the elevation of our own soldiers to the status of heroes for the sacrifices they were prepared to make in the service of their country. Aware of the experience of veterans of Vietnam, who were not welcomed home with much enthusiasm after their service in that unpopular war, we have made sure that the young men and women we send to Central Asia are the recipients of our admiration and gratitude for their service. We demonstrated our admiration for the heroism of all in uniform. This gesture was made easier by the fact that no sacrifices were required of most of us. We could follow the advice of our president to go shopping while indulging our guilt about so much being required of so few, by lionizing those who volunteered to take the risks of combat. Reinstituting the draft, which is the fairest way of sharing the risks attendant to any military undertaking, is politically unsustainable. The sons and daughters of the rich and powerful do not, in general, volunteer to serve. In 2007, by one count, 11 of the 635 members of Congress had children serving in the military, mirroring the inequities in service participation of the Vietnam generation. Exercising our sense of self-preservation by avoiding risk is one thing. Asking others to hazard themselves for us in the belief that by anointing them warriors and applauding them in public, we have somehow done our part to support them is another. When I returned from Vietnam, I thought that nobody owed me anything for what I had seen and done. I no longer believed that the country was any more secure or our freedoms enhanced by my service. Nobody spit on me or called me a baby killer, nor do I know of anyone who is subjected to such mythological indignities. In fact, most people didn't care what we had done and seen. A lot of returnees had a nearly instinctive sense that all those lives lost and all the pain we had inflicted on ourselves and the little country we used to contain communism had been wasted. No important national interest had been served. For more than 10 years, we had all been pawns in a colossal misjudgment on the part of our political leadership. I remember a cynical bumper sticker on a veteran's pickup truck back in the 70s. Southeast Asian War Games, second place. Now at reunions of Vietnam veterans, it is fashionable to reminisce about our service there, remember the comradeship and the intensity that the dangers of combat gave to our lives, and declare that we were betrayed by the peace movement and politicians at home, not defeated on the battlefield. The damaged men and women who have returned from similar ill-defined missions in Iraq and Afghanistan have been, as we were, changed by the experience. Their incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder hovers around 20%, The increasing suicide rate among them is a vexing problem that the military struggles to come to grips with. The repeated deployments and lack of a draft fly in the face of any definition of a collective national commitment. When we think of these soldiers at all, it is to hail them as heroes. The more important question is, what do they think of themselves? And what do they think of those of us who have not shared their awful experiences and cannot understand what they have been through? Has some important national objective been accomplished that justifies their sacrifices? Have our freedoms really been at stake? Maintaining a sense of unity among people in a diverse society is challenging because many seek to divide us for political or personal gain. But nothing has the power to unite us like fear. The real threat to our way of life that World War II represented brought us together in a massive commitment to defeat those who were making credible efforts to violently impose their philosophies on the rest of the world. We were prepared to sacrifice anything to defeat them. And we did. The many conflicts in which we have been engaged since have been, in contrast, wars of choice. Each one has been justified as necessary to defend our values, especially freedom. But viewed through the prism of history, it is difficult to see how we are freer or safer now than we were 65 years ago. The long Cold War struggle with communism was won economically rather than on the battlefield. But it suited some need within us to have the Soviet Union as an enemy for 50 years while we cowered under our school desks in the shadow of mutually assured destruction, mad. It is hard to see the radical Islamists as constituting the same level of threat. Yet they frighten us into walking around airports in our stocking feet and turning out to rallies to prevent the building of mosques. When will we get a grip on our reactions to the parade of malefactors who have always inhabited the world and the space under our beds? We live in dangerous times, as we always have. We are all subject to the realities of threatening outcomes and an unhappy ending to each of our stories. Perfect safety is an illusion, and a fear that we might lose the people and principles that mean the most to us is a natural reaction to life's uncertainties. Consider the things we do that enhance or detract from our moral sense of ourselves. Every action we take has consequences that illuminate how closely our professed beliefs comport with our behavior. So it is with the societies we create. If we allow the enemy of the moment to frighten us into actions that violate our core values, we have lost some essential faith in ourselves as a good and generous people. Chapter 4. You have never suffered enough. The truth will set you free, but not until it is finished with you. David Foster Wallace. Those who have suffered a catastrophic loss, such as the death of a child or spouse, often take slender consolation in the idea that they have paid their dues to God or to the universe, and that no more sacrifices of this magnitude will be required of them. I indulged this fantasy for a time after my 22-year-old son Andrew killed himself in the grip of bipolar illness some years ago. Surely, I thought, no further misfortune could befall me that would approach this. 7 months after Andrew's death, my 6-year-old son Lucas was diagnosed with a particularly virulent form of leukemia. 6 months later, he too was dead. What can we learn from such apparently random devastation? That there is no defense against the vagaries of chance in this life? That we are being tested by having our worst fears realized? That we need more lessons in powerlessness and humility? I couldn't figure it out. Then it began to dawn on me that there is nothing to figure out. That as Robert Frost, who lost 4 of his 6 children, said in his old age, in 3 words I can sum up everything I have learned about life. It goes on. Such a conviction is at once both defenseless and liberating. Nobody tells us when we are young that there are no limits to pain. Instead, most of us are allowed to indulge the fantasy that if we do well in school, work hard, and respect authority, we will be spared the crushing grief that is the fate of other people, those we don't know. It is doubtless just as well that we are not burdened with the gift of foresight. In the yearbook marking my 50th college reunion, I closed my brief autobiography with the paraphrase of a favorite song. I wish somehow I didn't know now what I didn't know then. A subset of the category we label courage is resilience, the capacity to respond to adversity with a determination not to be defeated by it. Anyone who has attended a meeting of the Compassionate Friends, an organization of bereaved parents, learns that people vary widely in their reactions to grief. About one-third of those who have sustained such a loss appear defeated by it. Their best hopes have been burned to ashes, and they will never recover. For another third, time will do its work, and they will struggle back to some semblance of their former selves. How long this process takes is individual and unpredictable. A third group manifests the reality proposed by Ernest Hemingway. The world breaks everyone, and afterward, some are strong at the broken places. These are the people who plant the gardens, establish the memorial funds, accompany others in their mourning. They are more than survivors. They have prevailed. One of these people, Elizabeth Edwards, was my friend. After the loss of her son, Wade, at 16, in a car crash, she went on to establish a computer lab for high school students in his name. She became a national expert on healthcare, had two more children, one at 48 and the other at 50, wrote two books, one of them titled Resilience, and was a model of what one bereavement expert has described as a triumphant survivor. And yet she had yet more grief to endure, her husband's infidelity and her own losing battle against breast cancer. All of this she confronted head-on and with a notable lack of self-pity. Her heart was broken, but she was not, and she stayed in the fight until the very last. Who among us can calculate the sum or purpose of human suffering? We are required by our nature and the imperative of human survival to attach ourselves to others who become our hostages to fate. This opens us to loss and to grief. We live with an instinctive doubt about the larger meaning of our lives. We survive in the hearts of others who love us, but we also know that when they are gone, so are we. Although we strive to be special, none of us leaves behind much of a footprint to mark our passage upon the earth. We inhabit a small planet in a minor solar system. We appear to be equidistant from the unfathomable distances of the universe and the submicroscopic particles of which we are made. And yet the questions of why we are here, how best to live, and the meaning of the losses that we endure remain answerable only by the bargains with life that each of us choose to strike. We search for justice and find mainly random events. We watch the wicked prosper and the good suffer. We console ourselves with the idea of ultimate fairness on some other plane where each of us will be punished and rewarded according to his or her behavior on earth. But we lack evidence for that and so have to live with the imperfect justice that we mete out to each other. What terrifies us is the randomness that characterizes the systems for reward and punishment that we have created. The rich appear to have a better chance for success in almost every area, including the legal system. The inscription on the courthouse may read, "Equal justice under law," but few of us believe that this laudable goal is regularly achieved. American prisons are warehouses for the poor and uneducated and minority members of the society. 2 million of our citizens are incarcerated, the highest percentage of any nation on earth. What does this say about us? Any institution is a distillation of the dominant values of the society. Our legal arrangements are no exceptions. Just as with our educational and healthcare systems, our laws and their application favor the wealthy. When a tornado passes through town, who is most at risk? The people in the trailer park or those living in the big houses? When a recession hits, who suffers the most? Living with such inequities indefinitely is impossible. Sooner or later, the disparity in suffering either sparks collective outrage or results in the numbing of our critical faculties and the betrayal of our deepest values. Our high incarceration rate indicates who and what we are afraid of. Aside from people who commit acts that have always been considered crimes, murder, theft, robbery, and so on, we have filled our jails with those who pose little threat to the rest of us. In 2002, 54.7% of federal prisoners were imprisoned for drug crimes. Our attempt to control the flow and use of illegal substances has been a colossal failure that has served mainly to increase the price of illegal drugs, enrich some of the most contemptible people in society, provoke a culture of death and violence in our inner cities, and swell our prison population without materially reducing the consumption of drugs or confronting the issues of addiction that drive such behavior. It is as if we learned nothing from our 14-year experience with the prohibition of alcohol, which, although it destroys many lives, is now freely available, relatively inexpensive, and no longer the source of widespread crime. We can manage the millions of people who become addicted to alcohol without throwing them in jail or otherwise declaring war on a common human craving. We all also benefit from the taxes people pay to drink. What we choose to punish people for is a good indication of what we fear. Apart from the prohibitions contained in the Ten Commandments, the complexity of modern society has required the punishment of crimes apparently unanticipated by God when He handed the tablets to Moses, notably sex offenses, including rape. An interesting commentary on our fears is that we imprison people for the misuse of controlled substances that are consumed for the sole reason that they make people feel better, albeit temporarily. To live peaceably with each other, we have decided that society must control certain appetites. If, as in the case of drugs, this control proves impossible, our response is to redouble our efforts. Imagine if all the money we spend interdicting the commercial flow of illegal substances and punishing those who use and sell them were turned to other purposes, starting with substance abuse treatment. This same line of thinking has gained little traction when applied to our foreign wars. And so we suffer twice, in the broken lives and withered hopes of the addicted in their relentless pursuit of evanescent pleasure, and in the suffering we as a society exact on those who use and traffic in these substances. We spend billions and distract law enforcement from other, more important crimes, even as it becomes apparent that this is a war without end and without the prospect of victory. As with most of our wars, there are those who profit. The armed bureaucracies, the builders of jails, the makers of surveillance equipment, and the successful perpetrators of the crimes that we have created. The deeply moralistic streak within the society that yearns to prohibit motivated behaviors, notably those driven by drugs and sex, becomes enshrined in our legal codes, even as 17% of us die from obesity-related disorders, and 20% of us still smoke. Drug prohibitions reflect irrational behavior that is not only ineffective, but also manifests the fear that somewhere, somehow, someone is having a better time than we are. We all dread the forbidden appetites within ourselves that periodically burst into view. However, we no longer punish marital infidelity, which has come to be seen as a destructive behavior that ruins lives, but is, in most cases, forgivably human. If we prosecuted people for hypocrisy, think of the prisons we would need. Would that we could be as tolerant and helpful with our other failed attempts to suppress our deepest desires. There is enough suffering to go around without criminalizing our frequent confusion about the difference between pleasure and happiness. The legal system is a blunt instrument with which to make this distinction.